Yeah, sure.
Just to make sure I understand
yeah.
what the homework is asking for.
So, the first problem in the homework, this asks about the inverse of an element in the quotient ring. So, we work modulo a polynomial, we work modulo x squared plus x plus 1, and I ask you to find the inverse of the element a plus x plus 1 in the quotient ring. Okay, so what does this mean? The way how we do arithmetic in the quotient ring, very good. The way we do arithmetic in the quotient ring, we multiply representatives, right? So when I multiply this with a representative of the inverse, I want to get something which represents 0 in the quotient ring. So I want to get, sorry, not 0, which represents 1 in the quotient ring. So what I want is really that x plus 1 times ax plus b is equal to 1 plus some multiple of x squared plus x plus 1. And that's now exactly the same problem as we did at the very start of the course when we looked at inverses modulo. It's really the same problem. It's just clothed in a different way. It's just the problem of asking, find the inverse of x plus 1 modulo x squared plus x plus 1. So what you need to do is you need to do the extended Euclidean algorithm. You calculate the GCD of x plus 1 with x squared plus x plus 1. And then you represent that your GCD will be 1, and you express it as a sum, as a multiple of x plus 1 and a multiple of x squared plus x plus 1. And that multiple which you have here, that will be ax plus b, and that will be your inverse. Okay? Other questions? And I know this is in some way from the process, it's not really anything new over what we did earlier, but it is, it's just the formulation is new. And it's there just as a reminder that arithmetic in a quotient ring basically is just a generalization of modulo arithmetic. Of course, if our ideal was not generated by a single polynomial, if we couldn't generate it by a single polynomial, finding inverses would be much harder. Then we don't really know how to do it. And that's unfortunately a fact of life for this course. I can show you certain general concepts. I can show you in examples, in particular cases, how one can compute certain things. But if you just look at the arbitrary problem, typically, there are no methods for the arbitrary method is there which would solve the arbitrary problem. Don't worry about this. You won't be asked to do things where no one knows a good method how to do it. Okay, any other questions? No? Okay. So, when we have a quotient ring, we often want to connect it in some way with the original ring, and the connection in a formal way is given by something which is called the natural homomorphism. So let me define this. Let's say R is a ring. I have an ideal A in R. Then I consider the following map. I consider a map which maps an element R to the coset A plus R. So I simply map every element to the coset which it is contained in. Okay. And this map, let's call it phi, is called the natural homomorphism of R by A. Okay. Natural because in some way That's the obvious thing for such a map to do, right? If you want to go in the quotient ring, you need to describe what happens with elements. Well, for lack of better ideas, you map every element to the coset where it's contained. So that's why it's called natural. It's called homomorphism because it is a homomorphism. So let's briefly establish this. This map is a homomorphism. And it is also onto. It is onto, and the kernel of phi is the ideal A. Okay. So let's briefly prove this. And the proof for this is very straightforward. It's essentially just the definitions of quotient rings and arithmetic in the quotient ring. So why is it a homomorphism? Well, if I take R plus S and I apply phi to it, what is it? By definition of phi, this is A plus R plus S. And by the definition of arithmetic in the quotient ring, this is A plus R plus A plus S. And by definition of phi again, this is phi of R plus phi of S. And the products work in the same way. Multiplication works in the same way. You just replace this, 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 and this addition by multiplication. So it clearly is a homomorphism. Okay, so phi is a homomorphism. Why is it onto? For onto, I just need to show that every element of the quotient ring is obtained, right? So let's look at an arbitrary element of the quotient ring. What is an arbitrary element of the quotient ring? It is some coset of A. So how does your arbitrary coset look like? It looks A plus R for R, an element in the ring. That's what a coset is. And that's, of course, the image of the element R. Not very surprising. So it is an image. So every element of the quotient ring is obtained as image. So phi is onto. Okay, last remark, what is the kernel of phi? The kernel of this natural homomorphism. Well, by definition of the kernel, it consists of those elements R and R, so that phi of R is the zero element of the image. Okay, what is the zero element of the image? That is the coset A plus zero, right? What is the image of little r by definition of the natural homomorphism? It is A plus R. Okay, and now I just use the criterion for equality of cosets. When is A plus R equal to A plus 0? That's the case if and only if R minus 0 is an A, and R minus 0, of course, is R. So it's exactly those elements which lie in A, and therefore it is A itself. So the kernel of the natural homomorphism, in some way not very surprising, is just the ideal itself. Okay. So in particular, what we have established at this point is the converse of a property which I mentioned earlier. We had seen, if I have a homomorphism, the kernel is always an ideal. Now we have the converse. Every ideal is the kernel of a homomorphism, namely the natural homomorphism. Every ideal is the kernel of a homomorphism. So ideals are exactly the kernels of homomorphism, and that's an alternative characterization of ideals. Okay, so that's the natural homomorphism, and its kernel, the ideal by which we took the quotient ring. Yeah? Correlate, C-O-R for corollary, yeah. Sorry. And corollary just means, well, if you want, you can just call it also lemma or theorem or so. It just is, well, if you want a slightly denigrating term, we're claiming this isn't really worth to be called a lemma on its own because it so follows so easily. That's just what corollary means. It's something which follows immediately without really thinking. And if you would just call everything theorem or everything lemma, the world would stay basically the same as it is. Just I would be deprived of some fancy terms. Okay. Right. What we did last time is we looked at some properties of ideals to get certain things happening in the quotient ring. Namely, we looked at how can we make the quotient ring an integral domain? And if our original ring already is a commutative ring with one, we saw this will happen if and only if the ideal is what we called a prime ideal. Prime ideal meaning that if I have two elements whose product lies in the ideal, one of the factors has to be in the ideal. And if we look at the particular case, so this might be worth mentioning. If we look at important examples, the integers and the, say, polynomials in one variable. Let's just remember, if R is the integers or R is the polynomials over a field, then every ideal in R is principal. What did principal mean? Again, principal meant it can be generated by a single element. And the reason is simply because we have a GCD. The ideal generated by elements A1 up to AK, this ideal is the same as the ideal generated by the GCD of A1, A2, up to AK. And the reason for this is clearly each of these numbers is a multiple of the GCD, right? So the reason for this is which inclusion do I want? I want all of these elements are in there. Sorry, this is this inclusion, right? Each AI is a multiple of the GCD. So if I look at the multiples of the GCD, certainly all the AIs are multiple of the GCD. So all the AIs lie in this ideal. So therefore, clearly the ideal generated by these AIs must lie in the ideal generated by this element. Vice versa, we use the fact that we have the extended Euclidean algorithm and that by the extended Euclidean algorithm, algorithm states that the GCD can be written as R1 times A1 plus R2 times A2 plus and so forth plus RK times AK. Yes, here I have more than two terms, How do we get it for more than two terms? Basically, by iterated application. We first take the Euclidean algorithm for a pair of two, and then we take the GCD of their GCD with the next number and so forth. And that would give us such an expression, right? And if I can write the GCD in this form, that means that the GCD actually must be an element of this ideal, and therefore the ideal generated by the GCD must lie in this ideal. So in these cases where I have a GCD and the Euclidean algorithm, every ideal is a principal ideal. Okay. What are the prime ideals in these cases? So in this case, what are the prime ideals? Well, what was the definition of prime ideal? It meant if a product was in there, one of the factors had to be in there. So, if you look at this, an ideal A, which I now know must be generated by a single element, let's say it's generated by an element R, is a prime ideal. Okay. So what does it mean that a product lies in the ideal? So what I want is the condition means if A times B lies in this ideal, is in A, what does it mean? This means that A times B can be written as a multiple Q times R. That means that A, this property has to imply that A is in the ideal or B is in the ideal. Well, so this means that A is equal to Q1 times R, or B is equal to Q2 times R. So if a product is, if the product of A and B has a factor R, that means A has to have a factor R or B has to have a factor R. Well, if we look at it, let's first look at the integers. In the integers, we know we have a unique factorization into prime numbers, right? So that means if, well, let's first look that if R would be a product of different, of would be a product of prime numbers, then certainly something like this could happen, right? If R is 4, I could choose A is 2 and B is 2. But if R is a prime number, I cannot factor it at all. And then in particular, if I have a factor of a prime number R here, that factor must occur here. And because of unique factorization, it must divide A or it must divide B. So if my ring is the integers, this is the case if and only if R is a prime number. And actually, I have to permit also the negative of a prime number, because minus one is a unit and multiplication by a unit really doesn't change things there. So that's another reason why we have the term prime ideal there. In the integers, the prime ideals are simply the ideals generated by prime numbers. If we take as ring the polynomials over a field, one can show there that we still have basically something like prime numbers. We have polynomials which we cannot factor any further. And you might have seen in school already examples where you factored polynomials, or you've seen it in calculus too when you did partial fractions. So if R is the polynomials over a field, there are polynomials in R which cannot be factored, if factored into factors of smaller degree. Why do I say factored into factors of smaller degree? I could factor x squared plus 1, I could factor it into 2 times 1 half x squared plus 1 half. And that's not really a factorization which I consider as a proper polynomial factorization. And I don't consider it as proper because 2 or 1 half is simply a unit in the polynomial ring. That's the same reason why a factorization 7 is equal to minus 7 times minus 1 does not take away from the fact that 7 is a prime number. So factors which are units, I don't really count for such factorization. So I can look at polynomials, and now basically I take this as a fact which you probably haven't seen the proof. I don't want to go through the proof. Now it follows from the fact that we have a GCD. One can see that such a factorization is basically unique. And then I can duplicate that argument. So now by the same argument, argument is in Z, I have, if I look at the ideal generated by some polynomial P of X in this ring, this is a prime ideal. If and only if this polynomial is irreducible, and irreducible is exactly this issue. There are such polynomials, they are called irreducible. So, irreducible polynomials, they correspond, they are exactly the analog of prime numbers, and the ideals generated by irreducible polynomials are prime ideals. These are the prime ideals in the polynomial ring. Okay, so if I have the ideal generated by a polynomial which I can factor, I know immediately that the quotient ring will not be an integral domain, that the quotient ring will have zero divisors. That's a way how I can construct rings with zero divisors. Vice versa, if I want a polynomial, if I want my quotient ring to be an integral domain, I better make the ideal generated by an irreducible polynomial, by a polynomial which I cannot factor anymore. And then I know I'm guaranteed that the quotient ring is an integral domain. Okay, and I now want to look at this in an example. Namely, I just want to look at some cases where I basically want to construct rings with bespoke properties. The properties which I'm choosing are in some way, you might say, oh, is this really the property I want? They are basically chosen a little bit ad hoc. So there is no deeper reason why I'm choosing these particular properties. Also, in some cases, you might say, oh, but I know already some of these rings in another way. Indeed, this is the case. But if you look at it from a constructive point of view, these other rings which you know, you were just told there are things which one can do. You were never really told why it makes sense to do such a construction, why this is not causing any problems later on. And that's a big thing what algebra does. It gives a justification why it is valid to do such things. So for example, let's say, and typically with this, one doesn't just say, I want a ring with some properties, but I start with some ring. So let's suppose I start with a ring, let's say start with the ring R, and say I take the rational numbers, and now I observe there is no element element little r in R such that little r square is equal to 5. Okay. Of course, in some way, the way you have been indoctrinated in school, you were told there is something which is called the square root of 5. You were even shown, oh, in the real number line, it lies somewhere. But now think of it from a constructive point of view. Where does this square root of 5 actually come from? Or why can we just demand to say there is something which is the square root of 5? Can we also always demand to have elements with particular properties? Okay, so basically at this point, think about that you only have the rational numbers. Forget for the moment that people told you about there is something which is the square root of 5. And a situation where this could come up, for example, is if you wouldn't have the rational numbers initially, but if you have a finite field. It doesn't really a priori make sense to talk about something like the square root of 5 over a field with 7 elements. What does it mean there? We haven't really a square root operation modulo. So if you work over a finite field and then you want a square root, you really just say you want an element such that the, say its square is something particular. And then you really want to do such a construction and you don't know a priori from school that there is such an element. Or you weren't, at least there was no one who told you earlier, yes, there is, or is such an element, and then what you need to do is essentially to do such a similar construction to make yourself such an element. So this is really, the object I'll get is not something new. The object I'll get is something where you will say, oh yeah, I knew this long ago, I learned this in middle school or so, that such things exist. But take this example as a template for a situation where I want to construct something with particular properties. Okay, so there is not such an element. Now I might be in an application where it really would be convenient such to have such an element. So assume we want such an element. Okay. And I still want to keep the rational numbers. Right? It wouldn't help me very much if someone says, yay, now here I have something else where I have such elements, but I really lose the rational numbers. So what I do is I take a new ring S, which is the rational numbers, and I take polynomials over the rational numbers. Okay. And why am I doing this? Basically, now I have the rational numbers, which I want to keep, and I have a further object, which is called x here. Yes, this will create the polynomials, but basically, I now want to massage x to be something, to do my bidding, to be an element which have this property. Okay. How do I make it to do my bidding? Well, to make x, or to make something which comes from x to be such an element, I consider the polynomial x squared minus 5. Okay. So this is basically a condition. I now read this as a condition to say I want x squared to be equal to 5. Well, it clearly is not in this ring. But it's a condition which describes, the condition described by a ring element, which describes something which I want to hold. I want this to be zero, right? So what I do is I take the ideal generated by x squared minus 5. Okay? And my new ring is the quotient ring. And I claim that's what we want. The quotient ring has this property. Okay. Well, what do I know about the quotient ring? The quotient ring consists of the cosets of A, so it consists of the cosets, and my representatives will be of the form AX plus B. And I can interpret this as, I can interpret X as the square root of 5, and AX plus B, I interpret as A times square root of 5 plus B, where A and B are rational numbers. Oh, sorry, not R, S, sorry, S, you're completely right, sorry. Rings were always R, but now I actually need, otherwise it wouldn't make sense. No, I need to take the quotient of S. Okay, and what I have done is, I now have this structure, I know immediately this is a commutative ring with 1, because S is a commutative ring with 1. I get this for free. If I look at this polynomial, it's not hard to see that I can't factor it over the rationals. Indeed, if I could factor it, I would have such an element. So this polynomial cannot be factored. So I basically get for free, or for almost for free, that S modulo A is an integral domain. So I have a new ring, which is an integral domain. That's very nice. I mean, if it wasn't an integral domain, really, I could might worry that certain things will go just horribly wrong. And in this integral domain, I can describe it, and I have an element now. If I take the coset A plus X, that basically represents a square root of 5. And what I have done here, and again, look at it as a constructive thing. I started with the rational numbers, and I now constructed something where I have a square root of 5 in there. I made this new. I made this which I didn't have before, in the same way as at some point you constructed the negative numbers by just saying, oh, it is convenient to interpret. You just say, I have something which I consider minus 3, even though I can't show you minus 3 apples. Minus 3 apples, I can just say, oh, I need to give you 3 apples to so that 0 apples are left. And it doesn't make sense to use this as a counting unit. It makes sense in a context of borrowing or so. But you created the negative numbers anew. And you just said, there are new things here, and it turns out it's convenient to work with them. And that's the same paradigm here. We've constructed something new, and now we suddenly have an element there, namely the coset with representative x, which plays the role of the square root of 5. We've built this as a new object. And that's something we could do over another ring. So if we were working, So let's do another example here. Let's say I take as my ring now, not the rational numbers, but I take the integers modulo 2. Right, this consists of two elements, which for convenience I also call 0 and 1, with addition and multiplication modulo 2. Okay, and now I observe in there. Okay, if I look at the squares, I have 0 square is 0, 1 square is 1. There is no element in R which has the property that the element square plus itself is equal to 1. So the equation x square plus x plus 1 has no solution in R. And in an application, it might really be convenient to have a solution. So what can I do there? I basically just duplicate. I do exactly the same as I did here. Just instead of the rational numbers, I take the integers modulo 2, and instead of the polynomial x squared minus 5, I take this polynomial. So I can construct a new ring. I can take a new ring. So consider a new ring. And what am I doing? I'm taking the integers modulo 2. I take the polynomials over this and I factor out the polynomial x squared plus x plus 1. What does this mean? The quotient ring certainly consists, let's give a name to the ideal. The ideal is the ideal generator x squared plus x plus 1. Can I describe the quotient ring? Well, the quotient ring consists of cosets. So I have the coset a plus 0. I have the coset a plus 1. The coset representatives must be polynomials of degree strictly smaller than 2. And because I'm working modulo 2, the coefficients can just be 0 or 1. So I get two other cosets. I get a plus x, and I get the a coset a plus x plus 1. Okay, and if you now look back at the example, which I did again relatively early in the course, when I constructed a ring with four elements where I said, this is the field with four elements, you will see that this quotient ring is basically the same thing. At that point, I just said, I take polynomials and I work modulo 2 and modulo x squared plus x plus 1. Well, that's exactly how we do arithmetic with these cosets. The only new thing here is that I can now say, yes, now I have a framework in which it fits. I'm not just saying ad hoc, oh, I do some kind of modular arithmetic, but I know I can do this. And now I know automatically this is a ring, right? Because it's a quotient ring, so it is a ring. So instead, when I gave you the field with four elements, I said, this is a ring and you can check it by trying out all the possible sums and products and checking the axioms for all the possibilities. Trying it out for all the possibilities is really tedious. But I don't need to do it. I'm guaranteed that it is a ring. So I'm even guaranteed, because this polynomial has no factors, that it is an integral domain. So I'm getting basically, again, for free, that I've constructed a bigger ring. It is an integral domain. We will see in a little while that we even get for free that it is a field. And in there, I have an element, namely the coset a plus x. Earlier, we just called it x because we didn't yet know what cosets were. Formally, actually, it is this coset here, which has the property that if I square it and add it to itself and add a plus 1 to it, I get a plus 0. So I have an element which fulfills this equation. And again, I've constructed that ring new. It wasn't there we've seen it in principle before, but from a constructive point of view, that ring wasn't there before. I didn't really have anything where there were these properties. And I made it new, and I made it new not just to have in some arbitrary way. I made it in a very generic scheme, and I made it bespoke so that my desired property is fulfilled, that I have such an element here. Okay. And again, that is really the reason for doing quotient rings. Okay. Let's do one other example, which is just a little bit more complicated, but it has the advantage that it really constructs something new. Something which we haven't seen before in the course. So new example, let's suppose my ring is, let's say, the polynomials in X. And now I observe that in this ring, X is not a unit in this ring. Right? 1 over x is not an element of the polynomial ring. Yes,
we can write 1 over x, but what does it actually mean? What does 1 over x mean? Yes, over the real numbers, you can say this is a function which is defined everywhere but 0, and you consider it as 1 over x. But think, for example, that you wanted to implement something on a computer. You know how you can write down numbers on the computer. It's not hard to think about how you would write down a polynomial. But how would you represent 1 over x on the computer? Yes, you can store it as a string 1 over x, but then you can't really do arithmetic with it. So what I now want to do is I have this ring, I have the element in here which is not a unit, and now I want to make it a unit. I want to make a bigger ring in which this x becomes a unit. Okay, how can I do this? Again, following the same paradigm, I'm making a bigger ring. I take as a ring S the polynomials in x and y. And I want y to play the role of the inverse of x. Okay. So what I do is I take the ideal, which is generated by the product x times y minus 1. Why do I take this polynomial? That is representing the fact that y is a multiplicative inverse for x, right? X times y minus 1. I want this to be 0. In the new structure, I would want this to be 0. Because that would mean that if this is 0, y is an inverse for x. So I consider the quotient ring S modulo A. Okay, and in this quotient ring, the element A plus x has the inverse A plus y. So in my new bigger ring, I still have the original polynomials in there. I have them in the form, the original ring still exists, R still exists in S modulo A in the form A plus little r of x, where little r of x is in R. So I still have my original polynomials there, but I also have now an element which would be the inverse of x. So I made a bigger ring in which I have an inverse of x. Yeah, describing the elements of this bigger ring is now a little bit more messy to write down nice canonical representatives, and that's because we have two variables here. That's not something which I want to do here. I don't really want to do now much work in this ring, but I just want to show you this was not much work. I just can say this, and now I have made a new structure, which I know is a ring. Actually, again, it's not that hard to see that I can't factor that polynomial. So it's an integral domain, and in there, suddenly I have an inverse of x. I don't necessarily have an inverse of x plus 1, because I haven't demanded it, but x has an inverse, and I've made this new with this particular property so that it will hold. Okay. And I know I've gone quite a bit over these examples, and I'm stressing it quite a bit, but I think this is the reason why mathematicians bother with things like quotient rings. And the textbooks, for some reason, don't tell you this. The textbooks just say, oh, and now new construction here, we have a quotient ring, it is a ring, and then some exercises about it or so. And you wonder, why on earth am I bothering with these things? What are they good for? And unfortunately, in other undergraduate courses, they typically don't yet use quotient rings. There you don't see examples where they are used. So what I really want to do here is I want to give you, this is in some way the motivation, why are we bothering with all of this? It's there to make new structures which have properties which we want, and
it's in some way under, if you want, this is really what is underlying mathematics, which is underlying some of the things which you were just told in school, where you were told, oh, yes, I have something, the length of the diagonal in this square, I call square root of 2. And, well, yes, there you had the length, and it somehow made sense to talk about length and therefore accept square root of 2 as a number. But if you think about it, with the lengths, I mean, if you wouldn't have the ability to draw lengths or so, there is a priori no reason why there should be square root of 2. So if you wanted to construct it new, that's, or something like this is what you would have to do. Okay. So these are some examples of making rings with particular properties, and we have seen already that this property of prime ideal is a property which will guarantee the quotient ring to be an integral domain. In some cases, we don't just want integral domains, but we even want fields. So the obvious generalization is to say, what property, can we describe a property for the ideal to make the quotient ring a field? And that's the next thing I want to look at. Well, can we describe fields in terms of ideals? Well, we had in the last midterm, in the homework, we had theorems proven, which together basically prove that if we have a commutative ring with 1, this is a field if and only if it has only 2 ideals, namely the ideal generated by 0 and the ideal generated by 1, which is the whole ring. So, if we have a field, there are only 2 ideals. So, if I could construct a quotient ring in which there are only 2 ideals, namely the whole quotient ring itself and the ideal generated by 0, and I would know it's a commutative ring by 1, with 1, I would know that my quotient ring would be a field. So, I somehow want to describe what ideals can I have in a quotient ring. And it turns out the ideals you get in a quotient ring you see already in your original ring. Namely, if you take the quotient ring R modulo A, the ideals you will see in this quotient ring are simply, they come from the ideals of R which contain A. Via the natural homomorphism where I started with today. But yeah, the details I don't want to do now today because we're out of time. So thank you very much. Have a nice weekend. And I see you on Monday.